It was spoken language, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We can see these evidences through the texts and the discussion of Patanjali, which we will touch today upon, will be about that, that the meaning of the word is to be recognized not from the linguists, but on the marketplace. You have to go there and see how it is used. So, it was two centuries BC, it was spoken all over the place. Actually, Sanskrit was always spoken. There was a beautiful article of academician Toporov from Moscow, who wrote about Sanskrit surviving over 6 millennia, 6,000 years. How come? How is it possible that Sanskrit could survive over such a long period without changes? So his theory was interesting because he says Sanskrit created languages, many, and withdrew from that creation back to itself, to its own origin. So to say, it kept referring to itself always while creating languages. Now we have this concept of Sanskrit and Prakrit. Sanskritam and Prakritam. Prakrits are all natural languages which appeared on the ground of Sanskrit. When the Sanskrit language was spoken, it was distorted in natural way. There are ways to distort language. For example, first and simplest distortion is that the last consonant is always becoming softer, softer, and disappears. It's a well-known linguistic fact. The consonant between two vowels also softens and becomes softer and disappears. Now we can see it even in English language. When we go to American language, we hear this twanny. The t disappeared because of nasal n and e at the end, twanny. There's no more twenty. So this is a natural process, and in 20, 40 years, these words change. So if Sanskrit would not keep to that origin, always reconstructing, so how Sanskrit achieved that, it's quite interesting. Sandhis were permitted. All these changes, phonetical changes, were permitted, were understood, yes. It has to disappear at the end. The voiced consonant has to become voiceless. It's a law. But then you have to remember that it was voiced. So you have to come back to it. So because these changes were regularized in the usage, they were remembered. They were understood deeply enough to really follow them and to come back. Not to follow them in one way, in a natural way of speaking. So if you know how to deconstruct it back, how to come back to the origin, you can safely speak that language. So you will, those of you who study Sanskrit, they will see the rules of Sandhi, and they will be surprised how regular they are and how important they are.
I have a funny question, which is just to bring up. One, because we were talking about the importance of knowing the root of the word and how it enlightens the language that we use now. And last week we went through the word daughter. It was just an arbitrary word that came from the root, I think, doitri.
Yes, do he
meaning milk or cow.
Yes.
And my question is really, because nowadays daughters don't milk cows.
Yes.
They drive airplanes.
Right.
They teach maths.
Yes.
They do a very many number of different things, and they've actually rarely milked cows. So my question is, what is the enlightenment in us knowing that daughter comes from the milker of cows? It doesn't tell us any more about daughters. It tells us about a time, a point in time.
Right, but
it doesn't bring forth an illumination.
I think it, to me, if you ask me this, I will tell you that it brings to me illumination, and I will tell you in what sense. And you will be surprised. First of all, that there is no such thing as daughter. It tells me immediately that there is no daughter. Daughter is something I created in my mind. Yes? There is a milky of the cow, there is a the rider of the horse, there is a these are daughters, yes? They are not daughters in a pure sense. This relation to the father, to be born from the father, cannot be defined by language. Tells me something very deep on semantics. You can't really make it constant. You can't really, you understand, yes, what it tells me. This daughter is a very relative meaning, which appeared in time and was fixed by usage, but it doesn't mean more than that. So also, you know, driving aeroplanes also will disappear in time. And then that time we will be just wondering what was that.
So again, then you're returning to the notion that whatever the thing is defined by function.
Right. I'm coming back to that, and today we will look into this discussion, because it will be exactly this discussion. How meaning is fixed to certain words, why certain words have certain meanings fixed. And this discussion starts from Nirukta, and today we will look into this, the oldest treatise on etymology in Sanskrit, 600 BC. It's a very interesting, a very important question, I think. But knowing that, that everything was so relative, even mother is creatrix, yes? There are wider meanings there, deeper meanings or more universal meanings, which could be applied to any...
Like even the parents, they're sometimes called the two fathers and sometimes they're called the two mothers.
Well, that is the usage of duality. When you say parents, yes, and then you don't say father and mother, you call them pitris, pitarau. Pitarau means father and mother. But it goes further, if you can use such words like brataro, two brothers means brother and sister sometimes. It's already kind of weird. So duality always meant, was implying two meanings, masculine and feminine.
I mean, just to talk a little more, but these two words are also very interesting, because the general consensus is the masculine is fixed to the male, and the feminine is fixed to the female. Whereas in reality, these things are very changeable, and actually again, they're to do with function rather than form.
Yes.
And generally people find that quite difficult too, because there's always a very literal understanding of the masculine and feminine.
Yes. Actually, there was a preference in the language for the gender, and we can see this, that was masculine preference, not feminine, because it happened to be so, I guess. Or maybe there was more to it. Some people will immediately say they are not here today, that there was more to it. Why the preference in language was for masculine gender. For example, if you have two genders, the crowd coming with two genders, then the preference will be for masculine to call the crowd. But if you have, in that crowd, you have one neutral gender, everything falls into neutral. What it says to me that there was no such preference for gender. Otherwise it would stay with masculine gender. So the preference for neutral is stronger than for masculine gender. It's in Sanskrit, yes? If you have one neutral in the crowd of male and female coming, then all crowd falls into neutral gender. It's a grammatical usage, yeah? So...
But she says then also that even a father can be mother and the other way around.
Yes, that is this.
I remember in some of those Vedic hymns, even the father has an other, he has a breast, you know, sometimes they say they milk the breast of the father. So what is the meaning? So the meaning is already there. These words are used in a universal connotation.
Yes, they are used more in the universal sense. And mother, matri, is used in masculine gender, and you will be surprised, because it's not fixed yet for the mother as she, matri. Matri, Mata, can be also He. That means the Creator, the one who measures out. It's not necessarily She. So, what is Mother would be Janana and Janani in Janana too, yes? Janani will be She, Janana will be He, the producer. Hmm. Wanted to say something? Looked like.
But in modern languages seem to be more influenced by their social culture, probably. If you look at like French, if there are girls and boys, it will always be masculine dominant if you use a pronoun.
Well, that
always.
That's the economy of language. You cannot really switch between the two because it won't be clear what you mean, yes? So the economy of language falls into preference of one gender for the crowd.
That doesn't necessarily mean that the whole society is sexist, because the word a person in French is actually feminine.
Yeah. It doesn't mean anything. It's just the economy of language.
Some writers do switch to say he and she, and they're able to actually speak very clearly and encompass the he and the she. And it's actually, when I read that, it gives me such a space, and I find it really quite beautiful and easier to access, because otherwise I can get a bit reactive when it's always he thing. And I think it's a really nice skill to be able to integrate he and the she like that.
It's being done more and more by modern writers.
Yeah, a lot of modern
by
writers.
By the seeker. In some yoga books, for example, more modern yoga books, contemporary, the seeker will be referred in very interchangeably as he or she across the text.
Yeah, interchangeably. No, it can be confusing. Yeah, it can be confusing.
I never find it confusing. That's what I'm saying. I find it liberating and easier to access the language. I can put myself in the experience.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's what I mean, it's a skill. If you
call the person he and then she, it can be really confusing for me. Well, but some people do, for example, Amita Mehra, she calls pupils in the school always she.
Because he is inside of she. The word she.
Yeah. Well, that is another kind of thing. Looking
people
at
when they write, use that. But I actually think it's an older generation that was taught to use he or she when they were referring to a whole group that could include either one. Because when I was in school, I was always very careful to write that way. But I've seen more and more modern language neglects putting. It's because it's too much to do. So now it's evolving back to being politically correct, gender correct. So then they are trying to incorporate a fairness in the problem.
I'm just saying that.
I was going back to your saying that if in a crowd of people there was a neutral,
right?
How many crowds of people have a neutral?
Well,
most people are male.
Most of them actually have a neutral. The neutral is usually invisible and not taken. There are many neutrals.
So I don't see that as any.
I meant grammatically. I didn't mean anything else. Only grammatically. And grammatically it is very possible, because when you have one mitram, one friend in neutral, coming together with
those
warriors and those dancers, girl dancers, one mitram is coming, all becomes neutral. So this is grammatical operation. It has nothing to do with more than that. And grammatically, this language is very rich with genders. It's not like English, everything falls into it, and only he and she when there is a person. All things are he or she or it. Yes? Things have genders. And because of that, it's a very rich fabric. You can see through many things. It is not so boring and not so selective anymore. It's mixed. It's a synthetic language. Yes, it's It's not analytic yet.
One question which often arises in this direction is it artificially chosen for an object in all cases to be feminine or masculine, or does it has a hidden or intention to call the table in feminine and not in masculine, or vice versa?
That is a deep semantic question, how it came to mean this. But I will tell you what. It's an interesting thing that, for example, there can be three genders for the same thing. So even a woman can be called in three different genders. Even woman. I'm just saying this to you that you can understand that it is something of grammatical value. But there must be something deeper than that, which I cannot reach now, at least in this short introduction. If we dwell longer on them and see why it comes to that, then maybe we can have some glimpse. Must be something. Can't be for nothing, these three genders. And they have very particular and meaningful relations. Yeah? No more questions before we go? So today we continue our studies and we are moving totally into this new period of post-Vedic thought, which is very interesting, because it is based on that period which we just looked into. So, you remember we started with this definition of the semiotics, with what is semantics, syntactics and pragmatics. And that is interesting because my definition of semantics is different from the scientific. What I defined here, semantic level of the word is oriented to its origin. It's not accepted. There is no such notion, even close coming, that there must be an etymon behind. Yes? The semantic level, which I was showing you all the time, is falling back into structure of language. Yes? It tries to define the object which it signifies. It is not dealing with the origin of the word. It deals with the object it signifies. So the meaning for semantic would be the object and not the origin of the word. Here we have a complete split from one time to another. In the Vedic time, the transparency of origin was there. Every word carried its own meaning from its own system of meaning and was applicable to the reality, creating this reality. Later, it changed. The word became a token for the outer reality, signifying it instead of creating it or making it from its own origin. Is it visible to you, this kind of shift? If this shift is visible, we are clear about the second stage. Because the second stage will become interesting in that sense. So, in the Vedic times, the creative aspect of speech was seen to be of major importance. That's what exactly I was trying to say. So that the study of language was based entirely on this knowledge experience and was therefore devoted mainly to this direction of thought. But, in time, this experience was lost and the memory of this knowledge no longer appeared satisfying to the intellect, which is always seeking a new and authentic experience. So from the time of Yaska and Panini, 6th century BC, onwards, a growing interest was taken in the cognitive and communicative aspects of language. Now we are shifting to that, what we know as language now, communicative aspect. Now, which was not studied earlier, notice. Earlier it was not seen. It was not important. What was important is that creative aspect of the word. This was a flourishing time in grammatical thought and in the philosophy of language, when great treatises on etymology and grammar, such as Nirupta of Yaska, 6th century BC, Ashtadhyayi of Panini, 5th century BC, and the Vartikas of Katyayana and Mahabhashya of Patanjali, and finally Bhartihari's Vakyapadiya were composed. This is a very intense time, yes, very similar to the Greek philosophical time, from 6 BC to 2nd BC. Now we are moving into the Yaska's discussion of the meaning. You will see this original thinking and the shift from one paradigm to another. We have to dwell on them. It's a very interesting topic, and very clear, very transparent yet. Later it becomes complicated and complex, you can't see a thing. But it is still transparent. Look at this. The arguments of a critic are given as follows. Every being should be called by the same name when performing the same action. Think about this. Such a, you know, simplicity of thought we already don't have. So if Ashva, horse, means running, from Ashu, to be quick, then everyone who is running should be called Ashva, horse. The horse. Every object should be called by as many names as actions are performed by it. Makes sense, no? Makes no sense?
So, ideologically, yes, but maybe practically, maybe.
No, why not? Do we not do that?
We do,
we do that. We say that the stone is flying when we throw it, yes? Mm-hmm. It is performing this action, that's why we are calling it flying stone. Whatever it is, it would be that what it is doing. Of course, stone will be there, but it will be flying. For the designation of an object is anyhow not clear when it is determined only by its action, for it can perform any action. Any object can perform many actions, and the object exists in itself before and after the action. This is the fresh thinking, for us, because we don't think that way anymore. So the answers of Yaska are quite interesting. Not everyone gets the same name by performing the same action. Now the difficulty comes in. Not everyone who cuts wood is called Takshan, the carpenter, but only one who does it often and regularly. Oof. We are entering into the complications of social usage and life. We can feel all that already waiting for us, that big context. Though one is involved in many different activities, one gets his name from a particular action only. It's interesting. There are even many things which get their names from their subsequent actions. It's not necessarily the central action will give you the main name. The name to, you can be named by something which just slips in, which is a very small part of you, but was significant in that moment of time, and suddenly you get this nickname and you can't get rid of it, yes? That particular quality which happened to be once somewhere in one occasion. It's like we heard the lecture on Big Bang. And you know how this name came into to mean this Big Bang. There was a theory which was opposite to Big Bang. And the very famous scientist was telling on television, "I can't believe in this Big Bang thing." Big Bang? From that time on, the theory is called Big Bang. So what can you do? just got it, got the name, and it got stuck to this theory.
Would that be how people get their surnames as well?
Can be.
Sometimes by the actions they perform, like Mr. Mr. Taylor, but then by the Dupont by the bridge, the people who live by the bridge. Or
But these are more regular names. Sometimes they get in a more funny way, yes, names.
Worse names, even negative names. There are even China names which means terrible. Mm. Or cut finger, and they don't change their names. I will change them.
But they are proud of it.
They are not conscious of it. Even they don't think about
it. Yeah, because it doesn't have any more that meaning.
Although it might carry the vibration of that, so it's trying to be very good for the person living inside that sign.
That's another. So, do we get this view, which is, if we could call every object by what it really does, what is actually asked here? You remember our scheme with two... what is asked here, I will have to go back to the scheme for a second. That's too far. Here it is. What is asked here is that the whole reality which appears on the side of the word has to totally correspond to another reality which is on the side of the object. It has to be totally corresponding in the physical reality, which is not the case, and maybe cannot be the case. Now what Jaska is answering is quite interesting. This that not every object gets the same name, and he dwells on it longer, and he explains why. What we see here is that a critic, by his argument, is trying to identify the image created by a word as it functions in linguistic reality with the image of an object as it functions in objective reality. He wants to have total correspondence and clarity between the two. He wants to establish a true correspondence between these two levels of reality, one of which lies beyond time and space, that's our subjective linguistic reality, and the other in the objective time and space. He wants this correspondence. The critic seems to understand the problem very well when he says that the object cannot be defined by a word, for it exists, the object exists before and after the action that the word indicates. Now what he does, he says that there is something there which is not the word, which word indicated in that moment of time for this object to be engaged in particular activity. Now the object continues to live and the word is not applicable anymore. The object does something else, so there has to be another application of the word. How can you really apply the same word if it is not performed? If the carpenter is not doing carpentry, why do we call him a carpenter? That's what he asks. Since we live, act, see, understand the world using our linguistic reality, the name once given to the object, whether it was relevant or seemed to be relevant for a particular speaker in that moment of time, could remain for some time, even if it had very little to do with any action of the object. The reason why this or that name was given to the object was not in order to satisfy an objective reality, but rather a subjective one. The satisfaction was not to match the objective reality and to make it relevant to the objective reality. There was a satisfaction of the subjective reality. And that subjective reality and its satisfaction cannot disappear in easy way. It should stay for a while. That's why cut finger surname cannot disappear. There's some endurance of that particular subjective definition. It was named by a speaker imposing his wish, opinion, knowledge, will on the object. once the name was has been used, it would persist in memory until a new name effaces or changes it. Now, there will be, if the gap is there, or this empty, vacant space, to call it again by some other name which can endure, it will happen. But if not, if there is no occasion for that splash, that fresh perception, it will still endure its own temporarily name. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very psychological view, tricky in a way. So Yaska emphasizes the difference between these two realities, as well as pointing to the corrupted and conventional character of the word, without answering the critic's argument about the approximate character of definition itself. He says immediately that not every object is to be called by the word which designates that particular action. It's not necessarily that. It is only those who do it regularly. He's still thinking in a regular sense. If you are doing carpentry regularly, you should be called carpenter. It is interesting to see these two views representing the transition from the Vedic understanding of the word based on transparent etymology, which was now already becoming obscure and non-functional in the consciousness of a speaker. There is no more reference to the etymon. Finished. We don't see the etymon coming in. It is not defining the meaning of the word. The meaning of the word is sought outside, in the object, in the designation of the object, in the definition of outer reality. You can see the shift. Before, there was no such question. So the critics' argument sounds childish to the reason, because they are still focusing on the inner source of words, while the reason focuses on observing their outer applications. That's why we can only smile, because he's still carrying that impression from the Vedic time, but he is already turning towards outside, and this is the fresh look. It's very similar in the way how Socrates saw the world, or Plato, in a very childish way. They're defining those first definitions. It's like they woke up in the morning and for the first time they saw the reality. Answering the question of how an object could be called by a certain name when it is performing a different action than that indicated by the name, Durga, commenting on Nirukta, it's much later, it's closer to our time, says that in spoken language, in the world, the law of using the word follows its own nature. Now here we are coming to a very difficult definition. How the word follows its own nature? Word has its own nature to follow. So there is an attempt to recreate that linguistic reality in itself, which makes no sense anymore. And I would not dwell on it longer for you here, because he speaks about swabhava, inherent characteristic of the word, sound, meaning, entity, and so on. But we will move ahead. The word carpenter then, in the pragmatic sense, what it could mean, carpenter, for you? How do you know that carpenter is carpenter? What is happening when you say carpenter?
Wood. Functional shapes in wood.
Yes, working with wood, all those instruments, things which he creates, a particular style of living, dealing with wood, knowing wood, and so on and so forth. So when the speaker wants to denote this complex of knowledge, ability, lifestyle, activity, by one word, he says a carpenter. So carpenter is a very complex meaning. Yeah, well, that's what I want to say. It's not somebody who cuts the wood. There's much more to it. Much more. There is the whole universe there, basically. But we don't see it yet. It's the universe approached through this particular angle, of this particular look of a carpenter. But in the linguistic reality, this word does not refer to any particular carpenter or real person. it evokes only an idea of someone who cuts wood for his living, pragmatic sense, and at the same time it includes the formal semantic of the grammatical usage of the word, syntactic sense. What I mean here is the word carpenter can be used in language in particular way. You can't use carpenter everywhere. You can't, you know, hit with a carpenter. You can't sit, or maybe you can sit on the carpenter. You can't sleep on the carpenter, or you, maybe you, even that you can try. But the thing is that certain meanings are permitted and certain not. And they are defined by this syntactic reality in which this particular meaning has to fit in syntactic sense, as it fits in the objective reality. Carpenter is not doing everything, yes? That's why he is a carpenter. That's why he has certain relations with the world. That's why the word carpenter has certain relations with other meaningful words within the linguistic setup. And above all, it has its own hidden source of meaning, an etymon in the system of seed sounds. Now, this is already forgotten. We do not have any relation to this particular meaning of etymon. Now, etymon takshan, or takshaka, is from taksh to cut the wood, yes? Takshati. Maybe it's not the best word to dwell on, because the etymology of this word is quite obscure. So when Durga says that the word lives and acts in the world according to its own nature, he implies that any word not only reflects an image of objective reality, but also introduces and implements an image of its own reality, which is hidden behind the etymon. There must be some other meaning which is always implying or implied by using the word. So for the hidden system of etymons, semantics, and the relation of the word with other possible word syntactics in the system of grammatical meanings, which we call language, influences the general contextual meaning of the pragmatic, on the pragmatic level. So we have a complex reality, and that sign again explains it. While we say carpenter, we say many more things than simply saying carpenter. When I approached this subject of semantics in the university, it was interesting because I suddenly saw that whenever you say something, it implies many meanings immediately. Our mind, or our perception, our consciousness is made in such a way that we do not need to mention all those meanings. We imply them. We feel their presence. They are not actively expressed, but they are all there waiting and supporting that particular meaning. It's an interesting, because when the artificial intelligence topic came up and they tried to build the meaning for the computer, that computer will recognize meaning, they found that they really can't do it, because in order to explain such simple thing as a book, you have to explain. Computer asks, okay, what is the book? And you say to computer, the book is the thing. What is the thing? Okay, just wait a minute. The thing is the object. What is the object? Okay, the book has pages. What are pages? Pages are with words. What are words? Words are to read. What is to read? To read for man. Who is man? And so on. So you have to say to computer to define all those meanings, and more you define, more he will ask you to define, because it's not clear finally where it ends, because structurally you cannot answer those meanings. You have to live them, you have to be them, and then computer cannot do that. It needs to explain with one thing another thing, and that is not an explanation. That's where the mind is stuck. That's exactly what our mind does. Tries with one thing to explain another without really dwelling on that living reality. This is the limitation of the mind. So more you explain, more is left to be explained, and when you finish explaining all, there will be many more things coming up in that moment of time while you will be explaining. So you will never reach the end of that explanation. So it's a kind of endless process of never reaching the limit of the meaning. I'm bringing you to this notion of the meaning which can never be reached, because as Bhartrihari will say later, it is by existence itself that the meanings are defined.
What would you say brings about some shapes of meaning is also defined by consensus, by collective consensus, is what we agree on certain meanings, that's why we understand each other fairly well. In that there is an agreement, and sometimes it's an unspoken agreement. After all, language is a tool by which human beings can
communicate
and express reality. So it seems that there is a collective sense that defines meaning without even having to kind of spell it out. And that's beyond culture, that's something that might exceed culture as well.
You see, we are stepping into the realm where the definitions of meaning are already not clear. Mm-hmm. We lost etymology, we don't have etymological system, we don't have the origin of the word. The word is only a token for the reality we live. It's only a convention. We agreed to understand table as table, and that's it. And we can change those tokens and play with them as we like. That's what we think. It's what our mind thinks. But the reality is more complex. So the Brihaspati speech, the original word, did not disappear fully. It is there. It is always invisibly influencing the way how we think and formulate. We don't see it anymore. With our mind we see only conventions and communications. But within, there's something else going on. We are blinded to it, but it is not blind in us. So, this is an interesting, because Durga tries to come back, though he is already in our time, comes back to that particular notion of the word or reality which has its own svabhava. It has its own Brihaspati speech behind, and it lives by its own law in the world. It will create many, many different theories later, we will see. So, for the hidden system of etymons, semantic, and the relation of the word with other possible words, syntactics, in the system of grammatical meanings. Now, I'm underlining here grammatical meanings, and I wanted to explain this to you, that there is such thing as grammatical meaning, and it's a very strange thing. It doesn't need objects. It's a mental structure of mental categories and their relations of time, space, number, predicate, subject, object, their relations. All these relations are very abstract. They are not concrete. They are mental. They are structural. They are structuring any reality. All the reality is structured by them. But they are abstract. And to prove that, when I was a student in the university, what I did, I made two identical texts in the structure, in the syntax. But they were completely about two different things. One was love story, and other was about some experiments in physics. What I did, I recreated the same syntax in two different stories. They sound completely different. They are about different things, but the structure they follow will be the same. This subject will relate to this object in this way, as that will relate to this, and this comes back because of that, and this will add to that meaning from this side because of this element. Now, this is the picture I drew to you without saying a thing, but you can see it because you have a mind. Now, I did this with two different texts. Then I read one text to myself, and then immediately after that I read another text to myself, and I had déjà vu. You know déjà vu? So there is a meaning in the structure. Particulars, that is what a syntactic is about. It's a structural meaning. Now, this structural meaning is understood as meaning in general. And you will see later, we will come to Chomsky, that the whole theoretical linguistics cannot come out from this prison of structural meaning. They can't break through because they lost etymology. I am emphasizing this particular thing because I think this is a great discovery, and it will help us all to see everything where it belongs properly. Patanjali, we are coming to interesting time, to 2nd century BC. It's 4 centuries after Nirukta. I skipped the biggest treatise, which I shouldn't do. It's Paninyashtadhyaya, yes? Vyakarana. It's one of the most magnificent creations in the history of mankind. Panini described grammar in 4,000 sutras, very brief sutras. These sutras, they are like thoughts. They are like thoughts which have to be unpacked, very packed, meaningful thoughts. He invented even, he made what we call meta-language. He used Sanskrit language to describe its own grammar in a way that only he uses it. He used particular cases only for particular meanings in his grammatical book. He used one very significant device which helped him to do it, because if you write all 4,000 sutras in normal script, you will get 20 pages of text. In 20 pages of text, he described all Sanskrit grammar with all exceptions and all possible variations of meaning in Vedic language and spoken language. Can you imagine that? How can you do that? What kind of mind you should have? Now, what he did, he utilized that device which is called anuvritti. Anuvritti is whatever he mentioned before is never repeated after. So it is always implied. Once you say it, it is implied in the next sutra. Unless it has to be denied, then he does that. Otherwise, it is always. So he built his structure in such a way that he deals with the most general rules at the beginning, which are implied to the whole language, and then he goes into particularities. He describes language in 5 logic syllogisms, so we call, yes? He doesn't have yes or no, good or bad, right or wrong. He speaks yes. He speaks better yes. He chooses either or. Better no and no. So his description is very flexible. You can imagine if you can describe rules under the topic better no or better yes. So that means that he is covering something which is more living. So he has a very flexible approach to language, which is not either or. And then, of course, I studied Panini yesterday in Pune University and translated his two books into Russian, first two books. He has 8 books. They are small books, but still. Now, he used his own terminology. He created his own alphabet, which is called Pratyahara Sutras or Shiva Sutras. He heard the sound of the drum of Shiva dancing, and it was defining for him alphabet. Ayun Rilak Elm Ayauch Hayavaratlam Nyamanaranam Jabhangadadas Jabhagaradas. It's like a drum. And what he did by creating these Pratyahara Sutras, now he doesn't need to say that A, I, U, Ri, Li, all these sounds have to be used in that particular case. He has abbreviations. He uses, for example, Hal for all the consonants, An for all the vowels, In for all the vowels except A, and so on and so forth. So he made his abbreviations, which is a very useful device. You can shorten the space of explanation. And there is more to it, much more, but I cannot dwell on it because you are not grammarians and it's not for you to really, maybe for now, not interesting. So now we are moving into the Patanjali's time, and Patanjali was one of the most important things Patanjali wrote was Mahabhashya on Panini Ashtadhyayi. It's a huge work, many volumes. This is exactly the same Patanjali, they say, who wrote Yoga Sutras, by the way. He was grammarian on one side, and on the other side he was a yogi. And must be that, because to be what he did for Mahabhashya is considered to be even greater work than Panini. Second century BC. BC. Yes. Now, it is his first time in the history of linguistics we hear such statement. It is not to the learned linguist you have to go for the meaning of the word. Yet you have to go to the market and see how people use the word. Then you will know the meaning of the word. We have a complete shift to another paradigm, starting from Patanjali. You can see it. It's our time. Now, all his definitions will be very close to this theoretical linguistics in Europe. You will see now. So the life which the word as a signifier has in the world is different from the conceptual or signified part of it. This was a new approach to the human tongue in comparison to the Vedic theories of the origins of speech. Patanjali points out to a different value of speech, which had not been focused yet on a communicative aspect in the life of a signifier in relation to the signified. We have another concept. Here I would like to quote one example which is most crucial for Patanjali, where he is discussing the topic of the simplest meaningful units. Now he wants to find out what is the simplest meaningful unit in language, which is very similar to the modern understanding of linguistics in regard to phoneme. So there are three words. He chooses kupa, well, supa, soap, and yupa, sacrificial post. They have the same accent, they have the same content, you see, kupa, supa, and yupa. They differ only in the first phonemes, k, s, and y. Therefore, concludes Patanjali, k, s, y are meaningful units. This is the work of the mind. You can clearly see we are in another time. Why suddenly these should be meaningful units? But yeah, it's his definition. For these words are distinguished by their initial phonemes. But at the same time, the meaning cannot be learned from these in isolation. Kusu here, while upa is also meaningless one alone. So how come that they have these meanings? Thus Patanjali admits that the phonemes have a differentiating significance within the units which bear the meaning. They have only differentiating significance, but not meaning in themselves. This is the definition which is given by Saussure, that the phonemes do not have meaning. Yes, A, B, C, D. So these units do not have other than differentiating significance in the word, which is meaning-bearing. Word is bearing the meaning, but not phonemes, which are building up this word. We will go more into detail about this. So what he says, such a unit he considers to be Sanghata, a single entity which is indivisible and one. It can be a word or a text. Patanjali here compares it to a chariot as a single entity which consists of many parts there which are incapable of moving, like separately. But if you put them together, the chariot appears and chariot has a meaning. The same with phonemes. You take these parts, you put together, and you build up something which is meaningful. Though these parts are incapable to create that meaning separately. The sound of the word and the text is simultaneous in the mind of the speaker, but it has to be pronounced in time and space, and therefore it creates an illusion of significance of the components. This is his conclusion. Because we pronounce it in time and space, the illusion of significance of the sound appears. Look at this shift. It's an interesting... If you hold that Vedic view, we could see where the shift happened towards the mental structure. So it doesn't see anymore Etimon. It sees that, yes, because of time and space, that we assign to it the sound its own significance. So Patanjali tries to discover the semantics of the word in a purely syntactic way, breaking up the semantic entity of the etymon into a formal structural succession of sounds, presuming that they should be meaningful as such. Now on this presumption, he kind of argues with himself. He says that s is not meaningful as such, that's why it cannot be meaningful. This approach does not help us much, although it brings some clarity about how the etymon is to be approached, as a syllable only. Now here we're coming to a very interesting, another notion, syllabic writing, syllabic languages, and actually Hebrew was also syllabic, and Sanskrit was syllabic, and then later what happened, there was a shift in Greek perception when they created an alphabet. They create an alphabet because they couldn't see the syllables in Hebrew. The syllables were hidden, the vowels were omitted. So what they did, they created vowels on the top and created their A, B, C, D. But it comes from Aleph Bets of Hebrew. It has no meaning as such. There are no syllables. There are letters. Letters which are not related anymore to the production of the word, an etymological understanding of this production. I'm speaking maybe a little bit far ahead.
Didn't he say just above that ka, sa, ya are meaningful?
Yes.
Like a chariot?
Must be meaningful. And then he says they are not, that's why nothing, phoneme is not meaningful.
So is it or isn't it?
It isn't.
But doesn't it say above that it is?
No, he says in arguing with himself that they must be meaningful, and if they are meaningful, then what is that? How this meaning of kupa, supa and yupa comes from them? It doesn't come from them. So, because these phonemes are used in other words, and the meaning is not derived from that usage.
But, so they're just structural elements?
Yes, they're only structural, or they have only differentiating significance in the word, nothing more. It's exactly what Saussure says about phoneme, only differentiating significance. But morphema, or as we call morpheme, has meaning. Morphema is something else. Yes? It's a root, or it's a stem, or an affix, or prefix, which has to be used already with grammatical...
So the etymon must be the morpheme.
Morpheme is already appearing from syntactic usage. It's already loaded with syntactic meaning of the mind, structural meaning. The etymon is still beyond it. It is still, it's like a pure color, yes, which later will be painting all different shapes.
Is it a sound?
Yes.
The etymon is a sound.
It is a sound, yes. A sound which relates to this apparatus of articulation of that sound in psychological relations. Very subtle, very deep, which we don't see, but we sometimes feel them as meaningful. And I could invite you to this exercise to feel these things. What is the difference between R, E, U? What do they do to us, to our perception, while we articulate them? What is happening when we press the tongue to the palate? What happens to us when we labially articulate U? Something is happening. There's some very general, very deep, universal meaning there behind, which we experience in that moment of sounding. But it is too general. Yes, it's like a color, which is not yet painting. So what can you say about red or blue or yellow? Not much. Yes? You can see that the difference is there between E and U, but how? And it's only Sri Aurobindo who defined these colors. And because of his definition, we can look deeper into Sanskrit etymology. Now, what I'm aiming at with Patanjali to finish with, because our timing is up, is when I say syllable only, what I want to say, if we examine carefully the nature of the sounds in speech, we will see that k is not a sound. It's an articulatory device. You cannot make it's a click, yes, with the back tongue over this sthana at the back. But it is only articulating device, which can be meaningful only with a vowel sound, when the vowel sound is there, forming it into a syllable. Of course, it reflects the significance of its place of articulation, it must be there. But in itself it has no sound and cannot be pronounced. So if we take ku and compare it with su and yu as these roots are, which are building these significances of kupa, supa and yupa, these are the original roots, then we will find meaning. And Patanjali cannot say that they have no meaning. Prototypal meanings, original roots, ku has many parallels in the Indo-European languages. English, cave. Russian, kopat. To kopat means to make a hole. We have even cup, yeah? Kup, because this has, it's hollow inside. Yeah? It's a very interesting cave, also ku. Bekave is v, appears because of u. It's just a guna of u in Sanskrit. Yeah? There's also no Sanskrit. Kap. Su, to press out. Supa, soup in English and Sufi in Russian, by the way. It is something which is pressed out, yes? From Rutsu to press it out. Soma from here, ambrosia, sunu, the sun, son, look at these etymologies. They still carry that that sound. Sin in Russian. You, which gives the different meanings to unite or divide. And it's also interesting, the thing, I think, both meanings are there, to unite and divide, because it's like a device of this, yes? However you apply, you can apply it as oneness towards the duality or duality towards the oneness. So to hold two in one. From here we have many derivations, huge, to unite, bind, fix, use. From here yuga, yoga, yoke, yes? Yupa, sacrificial post, is one of those. Yudha, the fight, because two are held in one. And so on and so forth. So this general meaning of this particular color is still there, creating different contextual meanings. So if he would look into that in this way, he would find the meaning of etymon. But etymon is already forgotten. It's no more the point to discuss it. The mind is looking for the significance outside. The single entity of which Patanjali speaks should belong to the origins of the word, to its inherent and hidden semantic, an etymon, and not to its conventional significance supported by the mind, examining the syntactic structure of the word. That's what happened. But what is interesting, and here we will have a bridge from Patanjali's time to Bhartrihari, and here I will end today, for today, that Patanjali, for the first time in the history of Indian linguistics and in general, defines what is sporta. And sporta is the term which we will be using from now on, the disclosure of meaning, the bursting out of the meaning. Now, it's interesting, he gives three definitions of in the studies of speech utterance. This is the meaningful word, dvani, as an uttered sound, and sporta shabda, as an impression of the sound in the mind. So the meaningful word, artha sampratyayakah shabda, is perceived through the articulated sound, dhvani, by the listener as spoda shabda, as an impression. We are not listening to the sound, he says. We are not listening to the sound as it sounds outside. We are listening to the articulation, to the articulation of the meaning. And this is the beginning of sporta theory. It's quite interesting, because what we do, we deconstruct. You listen to my non-English English, and what you do in your articulatory device, you reconstruct my speech. You listen to the articulations as you would articulate them, not as I do. Otherwise, we would be like a computer. You know, when I tried to learn English through computer, there is a special thing. You can click on it and say, yes, record the voice, the word. Computer didn't recognize one word of mine in English. Why? Because it listens to dhvani. It listens to the outer sound. It doesn't match with an inner articulation. I couldn't make it. I tried all possible varieties. I was very English, very American, very anything, and it never heard it. It never took it. How come? If we would listen in that way, we would never hear a thing from each other. But we can distinguish, ah, this person comes from France, this comes from Russia, he has this particular, oh, he's coming from Texas, and this one is coming from Alabama, yeah? And they have different ways, different
men.
They have very particular way, and
Yes.
Just to go back on the lovely way that you articulated this experience of the sounds, say as colour, this generatable colour visual sense, put it in sound sense. But in a way, what you're saying as well is that is to bring us back to this process of experiencing rather than mentalizing. So it's through the body, it's through experience that we really understand something. And that the mental constructions kind of dance on top, but it's when it sinks into the body that it's... I mean, I've been understanding these sounds not through studying Sanskrit, because I've been studying Sanskrit, but through chanting them and feeling them in the mentals. I've come from that place.
Rod would say through hearing them, and I would say through articulating them, which is very close, but a little bit different, and it's interesting, the difference is interesting. Articulating means that you are sounding them for yourself, so it means you are involved in psychological process of articulating, not sound, but some meaning, some very general, very universal meaning, which you are not yet fully aware in the mind, but it doesn't matter for now. If you would be understanding what you are articulating, that would be some Brihaspati speech. But we are on the way. So we understand it through the structure, through the mind, through language, but not through the articulation of the sound within the system. But we can really think about it and reconstruct it and see what it gives us. In the future, I think we will do that at the end of our course. We have still 10 lectures to go through. So we are entering into the most significant part of this theory. It is Bhartrihari and the theory of Subhoto. This would be for us a landmark. On this theory of Subhoto, we will build everything else. It's a very, very interesting theory. The disclosure, the sudden opening of meaning when it appears on every level, on the level of the sound, on the level of the word, on the level of the sentence, on the level of the text. And Bhartrihari says, all this is cognizable because the universe is. And we all know it already, beforehand. We all are part of it. That's why we recognize meanings. Otherwise, we would never make out. We would never be able to communicate if we would not presume the same meaning beforehand. It's a very significant thing to look into. So for today, we end here. Thank you very much. So see you next.
Thank you.
We can have a tea and cookies.